seeing all of our undergraduates, and I say this to those who are outside of our undergraduate family here, seeing all those undergraduates with their families cannot help but recall to me what it has been like to work with this particular class over the past 4 years. Please allow me to share a favorite moment or two with you after what has been a rather long morning so far. 4 years ago, right after this class entered the university, I was invited to a freshman masquerade party, if you can imagine that. I accepted the invitation, but I had a fully scheduled evening of activities and had to go to a black tie event at the Blair School of Music prior to the party. I decided to go directly to the masquerade ball from the Blair event. Shortly after I entered the party, black tie and all, a young freshman lady sidled up to me, and then she said, "Oh, how cute. I see that you've come dressed up like that dork Gordon Gee." She will be graduating from Duke next week. Then last year, I received an email from Mike, and Mike knows who is in the audience today and was at the time a junior, which read as follows. "Dear Chancellor Gee, I'm surprised by your commitment to Vanderbilt sports. As a junior, I have endured 3 years of you making a mockery of our school's sports program by not ensuring that we have a winning football team. Get with the program, or I promise I will start organizing a student group to send your pinko self back to Brown." Of course, I had to then respond to Mike with the following email. "Dear Mike, I'm so sorry that you are not pleased with the rate of success of our football team. I can assure you that their wins as well as excellence in everything we do is of utmost importance to me. As for sending me back to Brown, you had better come up with a better plan than that. I am very certain that they would not take me back even if you paid them. However, I have taken the liberty of arranging for your own transfer to Rhode Island. Packed warmly, the winter can be a bear." And finally, I recently was asked by one of our graduating seniors, he knows who he is, to act as a reference for him. I told him to send me his resume. In reviewing that resume, I noted that he had listed a recent summer job as being on the cutting edge of technology. When I asked him what he did, he said that he had mowed the lawn of a computer company. Well, ladies and gentlemen, is there any doubt that these young graduates are going places? And is there any doubt in your mind what a challenge it presents to me every day to have 10,000 of the brightest students in this country on this campus, all of whom know how to run the university better than I do and write and tell me so? You have raised them well. Now, on to more serious business. It is in the custom of Vanderbilt that the chancellor deliver the commencement address. That is an opportunity which is daunting, but one that I welcome. Today, our grand commencement ceremony gives a new perspective, quite literally. Traditionally, Vanderbilt University commencements have always been on a north-south axis, rather like the history of our university. But this year, we spun the compass to a diagonal. Contrary to any conspiracy theories, this change of scenery was not brought at the urging of the McGill Project so that everyone could get one last look at their residence hall. New seasons of life demand a different focus, a slight shift. At certain times, nothing should seem habituated or overly sure, especially when you enter into a new relationship with your alma mater. For now you have an alma mater and new relationships with each other. Today is another rite of passage, another your parents and families can attest in a seemingly unending series of rites of passage. For you, our young people, our loved ones, keep insisting on doing this to us, insisting that as you go through your rites of passage, we go through our own rites of passage too. This year marks another passage for me. Some of you before have heard me talk about my daughter Rebecca, who has appeared as a character in many of my commencement speeches. Rebecca is getting married in the fall, thank God. And I have already begun to stockpile tissues and prepare myself for the sodden emotional heat to which I will be reduced on that day. But even that auspicious day will be only the second rite of passage Rebecca has forced me to undergo this year. From prior commencement speeches, some of you may already know that my daughter is an obstetrics and gynecology resident at the Harvard Medical School. And early this year, Rebecca and some colleagues of her took part in a sting operation in which they would try to buy emergency contraception medication from Walmart, which had been denying the medication to women who had prescriptions for it, some of whom were my daughter's patients. When the pharmacist denied them, my daughter and her colleagues brought suit against Walmart. based on the fact that what the chain was doing was a violation of the Consumer Protection Act. And it was shown to be, and Rebecca won. And I cannot resist mentioning that the New England Journal of Medicine just invited her to write an article about this episode. So you may wonder why I begin my commencement address with such talk as this on such a beautiful blue sky day in May. Why on a day of such celebration would I ever tell a story like this one, especially knowing that some of you may disagree with what Rebecca did for her patients? Because I realized that what Rebecca was going through and what I was going through with all the heartburn she gave me pointed to something very important for me to say. I realized in the midst of all that storm how much it takes guts nowadays to act with integrity, to stand like that in the public's judgmental eye. I realized how rare integrity has become, for oh my, we live in an honorary age, encrusted with bad habits in our ways of doing business, in our ways of writing books, in our ways of doing politics, in our ways of conveying news that people need. And just like the sight line on Alumni Lawn, maybe we all need a good jostling so that we can see clearly again. I'm an old Eagle Scout, enculturated and adapted to scouting ethic. That on top of being a Mormon, could anyone be more square? So you can imagine the alternating amusement and dismay I feel, as I suspect you have felt it too, at the spectacle of elected officials and their staffs and of corporate officers, mostly contemporaries of mine, indicted for systemic corruption, for sweetheart deals and graft, and for lying to grand juries. You can imagine my alarm as a university chancellor at the prospect of promising young writers appropriating wholesale the work of others and passing it off as their own. You can imagine my discomfort as a rabid and inveterate fact addict at the changing marketplace of the news, where preemptive protestations of fairness and balance really cover up a skew and a slant, where declarations of all the news that's fit to print leave you wondering what was unfit, where quotations and bites can be presented without full context, where feature writing can be plagiarized, where sources can be invented, where reporters might work under aliases, where matters of fact are presented as matters of perspective, and where matters of perspective are presented as matters of fact. I find myself in a perilous place to be for an American who desires to stay informed and engaged. For how do I gain a toehold in anything when I do not know where to put my foot? These times are hard for us as Americans, when the trust we place in public officials whom we elect to represent us is increasingly shaken by faulty integrity. When the trust that we place in the Fourth Estate is shaken by our suspicion that what they report may not be everything we need to know. When the trust we place in corporate officers is damaged. When white-collar crime has gained acceptance as business as usual. When the trust we place even in the integrity of art is shaken by occurrences of misrepresentation. When even the validity of sports records is subject to enhancement. But for all of my discomfort, dismay, amusement, and alarm, I have to acknowledge that all of the people I've mentioned are only us, not someone else. We have allowed this erosion to happen. We in this audience and we on this stage. So what then has happened to our psyche to make deceit the norm and integrity such a surprise and truth such a risk? And why has it become an odd act of courage now to be honest? What may have happened to us when we no longer demand to hear the truth from our representatives, from those who are responsible for delivering information to us, and from all of us who bear responsibility for the daily life and quality of life of our democracy? Perhaps we have slid into cynicism, or perhaps because of superstition and magical thinking, we have convinced ourselves that something is not a lie if we believe it, or if it is popular, or makes our lives easy, or if we stand to gain by it. But to allow ourselves to think in these ways is to allow ourselves to live a life based on credit and speculation. Ladies and gentlemen, the only real currency we have, the only currency whose value does not fluctuate, is the truth and is our ability to seek it out. At this university, you learn that most quickly. Graduates, you know this. Over the years of your study at Vanderbilt, you have learned that experiments will not play out, that theorems will not test, that arguments will not hold if parts are faulty or if all the facts that can be known are not known. Everyone at the medical center knows a patient's life cannot be sustained through spin or politics or truthiness, but only through observable facts that certain combinations of treatments are known to produce certain results. Universities, by their nature, by our nature have to be places of truth and light, of fact and not fiction, of clarity that is not clouded. So why should we not have the same expectations for the greater culture in which we live, for the world outside of the university? Has truth become that rare and fantastical? You may remember that in Gulliver's Travels, on the last island he visits, Lemuel Gulliver encounters a race of horses who are supremely rational and ethical and capable of speech, who call themselves Wynnums. The Wynnums do not know how to lie, do not understand what a lie is, and so are easily taken in when Gulliver deceives them. When they discover Gulliver's deceit, having no word for a lie, the Wynnums can only call it the thing which is not. The master Wynnum explains to Gulliver that if the use of speech is to make us understand one another, to be given instead the thing which is not is to be left worse than in ignorance. The closer the description is to the object, the further we all are from ignorance. The greater the integrity of symbol with fact, the more accurately we are able to communicate. The more faithful you are to the words that you give, the more worthy you are of trust. I feel like these things are so basic, so Cub Scout, that they are not even worth my saying, but apparently they are not basic anymore, so I say them now to save you mandatory ethics training later. There is a place, a thing, a state of being, which is called in Sanskrit Sat, which means actually being itself, a place where there is no gap between what is said and what is meant. Sat has nothing to hide and nothing colors it. It is empty of complication and pure and safe, and refreshingly, it is totally apolitical. Sat simply means being, and its quality, satya, means truthfulness. Now, universities are not metaphysical, and I would be presumptuous to say that we can approximate such a pure state of being. It may not be possible to tell absolute truth with the tongues of men and of horses, but it is possible and imperative for us to try, because the more and more we do not, either by design or by mistake, we take ourselves further and farther from the state of being that is sought, and farther from our own capability, further and farther from being the best people we can be, the best civilization we can be. We owe it to ourselves to at least try, because if we continue to say the thing which is not, we miss our potential entirely and have to live in a mire of miscommunication and ignorance and all of the consequences that are brought with those. Maybe the best we can do at universities as humans, working with human knowledge and demonstrable hypotheses and facts, is to see that there is as little a gap as possible between word and thing. Such vigilance, by the way, is the very meaning of integrity, and it is the basis of all trust between human people that allows democracy to function. Universities were evolved by humans for the benefit of other humans, to dispel ignorance, to train humans to think critically, to bring humans to the capability of skilled discernment, so that they would be less susceptible to being misled or being the marks of opportunists and propagandists. Universities were created by humans to make ourselves free. Many have found it the fashion lately to accuse universities of having a cultural or political bias. Ladies and gentlemen, I will admit to all of you today that it is so. I'm going to tell you that accusation is true. We do have a cultural bias. Vanderbilt does, and we always have had. We are biased toward the search for verifiable truth, toward ideas and their free exchange. And I may submit to you also, our entire culture should have such a bias in all of its public life and public discourse. And that I dearly hope every single student in cap and gown today leaves Vanderbilt University a partisan of fact and free communication and clarity. For universities should not be islands of truth. Truth is not an island. It should not have to be sought out as a quiet, calm refuge amid churning seas of chatter, chat, and propaganda. It should be a continent, a whole planet. The dream of Vanderbilt University is this: to find out, preserve, and further elaborate knowledge for the elevation of all people, to bring more knowledge into our world, and to make it available for all, for the benefit of all. Every year, our graduates disperse that you may be missionaries and bringers of light, and conveyors of truth, that you may act with integrity in a culture that is being pulled toward disintegration. And what you have to know also is this: that sometimes speaking the truth can scorch the inside of your mouth, and acting with integrity can bring the angry gaze of those who oppose you to sear your skin. The prospect of plunging into such an ornery world headlong can bring apprehension, not only from within yourselves, but from those who love you and who know the world and who want to protect you from it. So I say to the parents and to the families, if I could just speak to you for a moment. At this time, we know that through their efforts, our children have achieved adulthood, and our loved ones have achieved independence. We see them doing something on their own that we cannot do for them, could not do for them. That was where I was with my own Rebecca for doing everything, and no matter how much I had done for her in the past, now I could only watch. My daughter, my dearest, on national television with her name in all the papers, my daughter, my darling little girl with Rush Limbaugh speculating about her personal life, my daughter willingly putting herself into an ongoing circumstance of confrontation for the good of her patients. But did she have to do it for the world to see? My heart was torn between wanting to call her back into the house, wanting her to be safe, and at the same time knowing that this is what I had waited for all along, that this is what I wanted for her, to admire my child, for her to be a heroine, even whether or not I would have chosen to do so as she did. But for any feelings I might have had, Rebecca did not do what she did to impress me or to impress any of those whose approval she might seek. When I caught myself in that realization, I knew that it was safe to let her loose. Because when I stand at Rebecca's side at her wedding, I will know that I am standing next to a woman who has tested me, who has tested herself, and whom I cannot entirely presume to understand, but whom, because I have seen her act with integrity, I can feel confident about letting her go. I know that you feel a similar confidence today as you relinquish an old way of relating to your loved ones. Just like shifting the sight lines on alumni lawn in the light of all their accomplishments and the adults they have become. I can speak with certainty when I say that your confidence is amply merited. For the root of the word confidence is the same as the root of fidelity. Confidence means fidelity of heart, with your own heart and with the hearts of your loved ones. It means worthiness of trust. As Vanderbilt, this day, this hour, this minute, returns your graduates to you after the promise we made to you years ago that they would become excellent adults and worthy of trust, we can say with confidence that our promise is fulfilled. And graduates, and I talk to you now, if I were to want nothing else for you, I would want this, that you continue to be heirs to the legacy of universities, that you be conduits of truth, that you be a culture of clarity, that you be, as Maya Angelou called Vanderbilt this year, a rainbow in a cloud. If I did not know you to be capable of great things, we would not expect such great things of you. I know that you can mount relief trips to Passe Christiane and to Washington Parish. I know that you can build robotic micromice. I know that you can play Hamlet. I know that you can overcome the effects of debilitating disease, and I know that you can beat the University of Tennessee in football. I know your powers because I have seen them. I have seen how empowered you are when you work for something larger than yourself. There is a power that comes in the service of a greater good, in the service of those who depend on you. Each one of you is a force for renewal, and all of you together are a powerful force. As you have renewed this university, so are you capable of renewing democracies. Democracies which are only stable when people have access to knowledge that allows them to employ their powers of reason towards their own self-determination and toward the long-term interests of their communities. And compared to all you have accomplished, is the truth then even so great or difficult a thing? Is trust? Is the free conveyance of ideas? These are only the first things from which all successful democracy and all enlightenment descend. And maybe after all we might say about them, truth-telling and trust and ideas are little things. So then, may this graduating class be as capable of little things as you are of great. May you be capable of the first things. May you love others enough to speak the truth. May you be worthy of trust. May you be on the side of ideas. Vanderbilt class of the year 2006, please know that every moment of your life, you are capable of bringing the values of Vanderbilt University, which are honor, which are integrity, which are speech and action, which have nothing to hide, which are pure facts that can stand the light of day, and free thought upon those facts, which are the values of all universities back into our world. May this day and all the days and years of study which it represents invest you with the courage that it takes to do so. My dear graduates, today I get the stage, but please know that throughout your whole career at this university, you have been speaking to me. You have been speaking to me about your capabilities and your capacities and your ardent hearts. Your voices, which you have activated here, and your words are instruments. Let your voices and words be endowed with satya, seamless and strong. Let them be the thing which is. And may you be, through your words and actions, heroes and heroines to yourselves and to everyone you know.